Les colloques du Collège de France.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to see you all after lunch. So we're going to have this afternoon in the first section three talks from Thomas Greger, Madan Rao, and David Bruckner, if I remember correctly. I think I do. No, Alex Valchak is going to be the third one, and then we'll have a break. So it's going to be a combination of experimental and theoretical work. And the first speaker is going to be Thomas Greger, who is from Institut Pasteur and Princeton University. Thank you, Thomas, for being with us.
Yeah, thanks very much, Thomas, for the invitation. It's an honor to be at this nice colloquium here. It's especially because it's front and central to my lab's interest in general. We are working on development, and one of the most fundamental questions in development is how a cell in a developing organism knows where it is in the body. And this is, talk is basically about this question. It's about positional information and how we can also now measure it and not just describe it. And I'll tell you by how I'm taking this idea seriously of position information in bits, quantitatively, how that had led us to unexpected insights into patterning, precision, and recently even a self-organization. And so here's how the story will unfold. I'll start by asking what positional information is, and then conceptually and biologically. Then I hope to convince you that it is necessary to quantify it. And that will then set the stage for a framework that connects information theory and gene regulation, merging ideas from Shannon and Wolpert. And then I'll use this to show you a new discovery that we made that was only possible because we have this quantitative framework. And then in the end, I'll introduce you to a new system, gastroloids, where position information emerges spontaneously through self-organization. All right, so let's start at the beginning. What do we mean by position information? So here you see a three-hour-old fly embryo. It's roughly half a millimeter in size. It has seemingly identical cells on the surface. Many of them, they're in a single layer. But they don't just divide and create copies of themselves, but they need to make decisions. And so they need to turn on genes, choose fates, and also build structures. And all that depends on where they are in the organism. And Louis Wolpert, over 50 years ago now, gave us a very beautifully simple idea how to think about this. He basically said, well, they are morphogen molecules, and they come as information gradients, concentration gradients, not yet information here, they work in a threshold-like fashion. If you're higher than a certain threshold, you're red. If you're lower, you're blue. And that led to the well-known French flag model, which is a metaphor basically for assigning fate based on position.
This is the anti-French flag model.
Sure, I took it from Wolpert, so he was British, right? All right, so and so this is not just conceptual, but it actually is really happening. For example, in this fly embryo, just 15 minutes later than this upper electron micrograph was taken, the lower one was taken just after 3 hours, where you see the first morphologic marker emerge in the fly, which is macroscopic, you can almost see it by eye, which splits the future head from the rest of the body. And it is a single row or column of cells here that happens to form almost always exactly at the same place every time. And so we began to wonder how reproducible is this process and can we measure how precisely this row of cells here can determine itself. And so we looked closely and measured this cephalic furrow position, that's what this headfold is called, in roughly 300 embryos. And what we found was really surprising, because it turns out that the precision with which this thing can form is of the order of 1%. So here we took embryos which we sectioned. They are fluorescently marked. You ask a computer to give you the crossing of these two red lines, and you extract this beautiful distribution function with a mean of 34% egg length, whatever that means. But important for us is this 1% in precision, which is at the level of a single cell. And it's not just this fold that has this precision, but it's an entire genetic network that, of course, underlies the formation of this fold. It starts with these broad exponentially decaying gradients, maternal gradients, that span the entire egg, goes through this gap gene network, which is kind of intermediate, and then leading to these famous seven stripes, parallel genes, which you may have seen on the cover of glossy magazines. And despite all the noise in molecular gradients and gene expression, this system generates these extremely reproducible outcomes, where you essentially see subcellular precision of 1%, both in this macroscopic fold here, but also in the stripes and boundaries. And this comes with molecular reproducibility to within 10%. So also on the y-axis here, this system fluctuates by not more than 10%. And when we first saw this, this was at the time when in biology, factors of 2 in concentration measurements for cells were meant to be precise. And here we actually pushed this all the way to 10%, meaning being a meaningful quantitative difference that cells take advantage of. And so this embryo isn't just robust, but it's quantitatively precise. And here's something else interesting. It turns out that these eggs, they also fluctuate in size, both across species and within species. So here you see three eggs of three different species. There's a Drosophila egg here. And they're labeled with a gene called Eve. They form seven stripes. And as you see, the seven stripes position themselves relative to the size of the egg. It's not like in physical pattern formation where this factor of 5 in difference in size would lead to 5 times more stripes. Something definitely very different is happening in biology. But also within just Drosophila, if you take here over 500 eggs and look at their size fluctuations, you see that they fluctuate by roughly 4% egg length. But I told you that these Eve stripes here have a precision of 1%. And that means that the embryo doesn't just encode absolute position, like let's say at 34% egg length we make a cephalic four, but they encode relative position. They position themselves to the size of the embryo, which means that and this is in fact what encodes scaling. Okay, so precision here encodes really scaling. The pattern stretches and shrinks according to embryo size. And it's even more than this because it means that local decisions must somehow reflect some of the estimate of this global size of the system. And that means as if there is a ruler, which obviously doesn't exist, but the cells behave as if there was a ruler from which they can read off where in the embryo they are. And so something else is going on. And that is encoded and locally and is accessible to each cell. And so together, reproducibility, precision, and the scaling now suggest that positional decisions carry more than just local information. And that brings us to quantification. This means that there's something we may hope to understand more if we actually put a quantitative means to what it means to say that a molecular signal contains information about position. And so can we move from observation, which I have done now, to actually measure the information being transmitted. And this, of course, leads us to Shannon. This is where Shannon comes in. He basically defined information as a reduction in uncertainty or entropy. If you have one bit of information, it allows you to choose between two equally likely states. Here you can ask, am I in the front or in the back of the embryo? That means you have one bit. And you reduce your uncertainty, if you want, by a factor of 2, because you know you're definitely no longer in the back part of the embryo. So this is what is meant by entropy or uncertainty reduction. And if you wanted to specify all 90 nuclei that span the anterior-posterior axis of a fly embryo, well, then you would need, it turns out, 6.5 bits, because that's log 2 of 90, in order to do this unequivocally. And so in other words, what information really means is that it's like the number of yes-no questions that you need to resolve uncertainty. All right, so now that we know what a bit is, let us see how we actually, how much positional information is carried in an entire gene expression profile, and how we would measure this and how we would quantify it despite the noise. You see, I plotted several of them, so these things are noisy. How do you, how does information deal with this? And Shannon's answer here is mutual information. It's a concept. And here's how this works. In our case, you have a, you have position X, which is essentially the output. The cell wants to know where it is. And you have concentration C, which is what the cell reads. But of course, there's noise, and so there's no determinism here. These things come in probability distribution. So there's a probability distribution for X, there's a probability for C, and there's also one for X given C at any given location here. Okay. And so the key question is now, how much does knowing C reduce our uncertainty about position X? And basically, positional mutual information gives us a number in bits that answers this question, and it tells us on average how many yes-no questions we save by reading this gene expression level, basically. Or, in other words, is also the number of states we can distinguish by reading C. And in mathematical terms, this basically means it's the average reduction in uncertainty about position X given expression level C. And now this is not just theory. To show you that this is not just theory, you can actually measure it and extract this from experimental data. And this is what we set out to do a number of years ago now. And we used the fly embryo as a test bed because it's really a beautiful system to make very precise measurements, and that's what you need in order to do this. And so we decided to measure the second layer of this genetic network that I told you about, the GAM genes, which are just transferring, if you want, positional information from the maternal gradients to the segment pair rule genes, which have these seven stripes. And so here's what the data looks like. This is the four major GAP genes, Hunchback, Cripple, Giant, and Knirps. You've seen expression profiles for multiple embryos. And you can extract now these three different probability distributions and compute the mutual information in individual genes and later also in many genes at once. So let's start with one gene at a time. And you see that the information is between 2 and 1 bit. It's always more than quite a bit more than 1 bit of information, so they're not just on-off switches, if you want. Hunchback even has 2 bits. And now, that's a nice number to have. The first thing you can ask, well, is it, would it be enough to get to specify 90 embryos? Well, if you just add them up, you get almost 7 bits, which would in principle definitely be enough. But it turns out that this is only true if these genes are completely independent, which is, of course, not the case. Okay, and so in order to really understand how much information is there in this network, in this entire network layer, you need to make, similar to what Manuel showed us, a measurement where you label all 4 genes at once in the same embryo with 4 different antibodies. And so make a measurement with 4 colors if you want. It's never very easy, especially if you need to be careful with all of the experimental noise that you can have in the system by doing so. But By extracting these distribution functions, px, pc, and p. Okay. All right. And so now, if you make this measurement, all 4 genes at once, you extract the covariance matrix, and you generalize the formula that I just repeated for Jean-François. And it turns out that by just exchanging C by a vector of now 4 numbers that you measure, you need a covariance matrix between these two, and that reduces your information. That brings redundancy to the 4, and it turns out you end up with 4.3 bits. But that is still a lot, because it's in fact enough for each nucleus to determine position with 1% precision, which is what we had before in the cephalic furrow and in the positioning of the boundaries and the stripes. But this was in space, and now we have it in concentration, which is really what cells measure, right? But we have even more than this, and that is, if you ask how well can a cell, can all the nucleus along the cell really measure their position? It turns out that they all can measure their position with 1% precision. And so that means that the noise is uniformly distributed along the entire axis, which from an information theoretic perspective means that we are looking at an optimal decoder here. It basically means that we extract the maximum information that we could, given the limit in molecular copy numbers that the system can measure and the biological noise that is present. Okay, and so the system isn't just precise, it's also efficient. And so at this point, I was still skeptic because it wasn't clear whether we really had done more than really a clever use of Shannon's framework in a biological context, whether we were really gaining some new insights, or whether we just really put another layer of description on the system, which now, granted, had numbers, but did we really gain new insights? We gained this insight of, yeah, maybe information is optimized, but this still doesn't speak to everybody. And that's when we tried to take it really a step further to get to the point of where it only was because we measured these numbers, these 4.3 bits, that we got to some real insight. And so basically what we need really to specify all of the identities of nuclei is 6.5 bits, but we only measured 4.3 bits. Okay? The 4.3 bits are still enough to position a single nucleus with 1% precision, but do we really get from that unique identities? And it turns out that the answer is no. There is an information gap here of almost 2 bits. Well, there's an error bar in measuring the number of nuclei, there's an error bar in measuring the number of bits. But give or take, we have an information gap of 2 bits that we somehow need to find. And it turns out that assuming 1% precision actually still means that there's quite a bit of overlap if two adjacent nuclei need to determine where they are. And this overlap is so big that in 20% of the cases, you would make a mistake. Okay, another way of seeing this is by writing a little simulation where you look at actual position and simulate what implied position would you get with 1% noise. And every fifth nucleus or so would basically get it wrong. On the other hand, that's not what we see in the embryo. Okay, what we see is that every time the embryo has all the stripes in order. There's never any stripes are flipped or misaligned. The patterns are ordered and sharp. And so this suggests that there's some additional structure in the system that compensates for this apparent shortfall. And given this 1% precision, you can then calculate really what precisely would the information gap be, and it's around 1.7 bits. And that's 1.7 bits per cell that misses, that each cell individually misses in order to determine where it is. And that would also mean that these cells make those decisions independently. All right? But that assumption is probably wrong. Probably it turns out that what's probably going on is that errors in positional readout aren't really independent, but that nearby cells tend to make similar mistakes. And if that's true, then the positional information wouldn't just be encoded in the profile, but in the relative alignment. So if it's independent, then the stripes would probably fluctuate like this, each one on their own. But if they're correlated, the stripes would basically only be able to fluctuate back and forth. And that, of course, reduces entropy and gives us extra bits of information. And when we put this back in the simulation, so some correlations, you see that it actually works. The curve aligns and you don't make any errors anymore. And so the hypothesis of there being extra correlations might actually not be so bad. But if that's the case, let's use again information theoretic approach to predict how long the correlations of this noise would have to be in order for this to work. And so the existence we can predict how much entropy is reduced by these spatial correlations as a function of correlation lengths, and for each, so basically by plotting, where's my pointer here? And so basically, here you have entropy. Here you have entropy reduction. Here you have your information gap at roughly 1.7 bits. And so, the more correlation you have in your system, the more entropy reduction you get. And at some point, you cross at a level of roughly 20%. This was an assumption of that correlation roughly decays as an exponential. That can be true or not. We'll see later. But this is a testable prediction, at least. Okay? We need to find correlations in the noise of these psi positions that are of this level. All right. Before we get to the correlations, let me first talk to you through what is actually fluctuating. So it's these stripes here. We can extract them from 7 stripes per peril genes. We measured several of them. You see that the fluctuations for many embryos, they line up pretty nicely here. You can get the sigma of the standard deviation of these fluctuations and then plot them for 21 stripes, because we measured this in 3 genes, so 3 times 7, 21 stripes. And you see that all of the sigmas hover around 1%, which echoes back from what I talked to you about before, that if positional information is uniformly distributed, or the positional error is uniform across the entire axis, which means we have we're extracting maximum information, or something is optimized here. And so even before we look at these correlations, we already see something that's, again, unexpectedly efficient, which is what I discussed earlier. And now, what are these long-range correlations? So we can basically now measure the correlation coefficients. We look at the distances between adjacent stripes or the next over stripe or the next over stripe, and we look at all distance between stripes and compute the respective correlation coefficient, and we do so and plot this as a function of distances between stripes. You see that we see a very long correlation. It doesn't look exponential, but that doesn't really matter. But it's definitely more than the 0.2, the 20% egg length that we have predicted earlier. And so the system encodes more information because the distances between these features are more reproducible than the positions alone. And what's really key here is that this extra information doesn't really depend on the molecular mechanisms behind these correlations. Whether the correlations come from, shared transcriptional regulators or mechanical coupling or something else entirely, it still reduces uncertainty in the pattern. And now, the really surprising part here, if you think about it, is that these 7 stripes from E, for instance, they are produced by 7 different enhancer elements, meaning pieces of DNA where transcription factors bind, and 7 different combination of transcription factors bind to these enhancers. And so they're basically independently generated, and yet we see that the whole pattern shifts from embryo to embryo. And this is really striking. It suggests that there is some emergent coordination, if you want, among these independently controlled elements, or some form of collective behavior that aligns the global pattern in order to preserve the local positional information. And that's basically where these missing bits are hiding, and they're enough to close the information gap. And so these long-range correlations weren't really predicted by classic models of pattern formation. We only got to them because we really had this information approach and ask, well, how many bits are needed, how many are present, and by taking this seriously, this led to this discovery that really challenges how we think about noise, order, and also positional identity. And basically, Shannon information is not just a vanity label that we put in the system, but a real tool and one that can open new questions both for biology and physics, I hope. So all of this was really in the fly, a system which is wired by maternal inputs and refined by generations of evolution. What happens in systems that don't really inherit a blueprint from their mother, where there's basically no external input-output channel to encode information, but where patterns still emerge. All right, and so this leads us to a switch that I want to switch gears basically for the last few minutes here and point to a new challenge for information theory, which is essentially self-organized patterning, where a structure arises without explicit instruction. And that came basically out of a wish that we had for years, where basically we spend a lot of effort in developing the fly as a physics laboratory to make measurements, etc. But we always wondered how universal the measurements or principles that we uncovered are really across other organisms. And 4 years ago or so here in Paris, I started a new lab that basically works with mammalian stem cells and generates organoids of them to see whether the physical insights that we gained in the fly are also applicable in entirely immersion contexts. And so here you're basically looking at such a beast that's called a gastroloid, and they're developing and expressing these maternal genes, as you see in green here. Some people call them pseudo-embryos. They're not real embryos because you generate them from embryonic stem cells, but they basically are shown to recapitulate the first 5 to 6 days of mouse development. They express the same developmental genes at the same developmental times and positions, and they even can form somites. You grow them from, as I said, cultured embryonic stem cells in a dish for 3 days. On day three, you give them an external signal, a uniform external signal, and then they start to elongate or gastrulate, which is what gave them their name. And they have been used to study quite a number of things, including cellular differentiation or speciation, which is what we are interested in. There's no maternal gradients, there's no egg polarity, and no there's no defined axis, at least not initially, and yet they form reproducible patterns. And so the question then is, do some of the same information synthetic lens applies to also this system where we don't have any input-output assumptions? Or does everything have to emerge from scratch, and if so, how does it do so? And so I'm not going to answer this question. I'm just going to give you a first foray, or basically a primer, a first quantitative primer, why also in this system, like in the fly, it really makes sense to go deeper and try to apply these theories to this biological system. And so let's start again with antibody stainings, because that's the easiest thing we can do. Here are 50 of these gastroloids. They're stained for a gene called SOX2 on the posterior end on the right here. And so you can now again project the gene expression pattern on the midline or the anterior-posterior axis. So you now get a one-dimensional profile like you see here, and you see they all nicely fall on top of each other. And in the fully on state here, it turns out you have a noise of roughly 15%, which is something similar that we have seen in the fly embryo and others before us, and also in bacteria and yeast. So it's nothing nothing really new or nothing really more noisy than in other systems. And so that's already quite surprising. But even more, if you do the same experiment 3 times over, it turns out that the means of cohorts of 50 gastroloids, they fall on top of each other within standard errors. And what's really surprising here is that the y-axis in this graph here is not normalized. And so 3 independent experiments, 50 gastroloids averaged, boom, you get essentially the same numbers, which means that also here there is information locally about something global in the system. You know that at position X, you basically have to generate, no matter what you do, 5.6 nanomolar of SOX2 or something, which is quite amazing. This system hasn't evolved. We just threw some cells that we got out of a minus 80 freezer in a dish, and this is how they self-organize to this quantitative precision. Quite startling. Now, you can grow these systems at different sizes, so it's easier than with embryo. You can just, you know, change the number of seeding cells from 50 here to 1,000. They change by a factor of 2 to 3, as you see. The shape looks quite variable, because there's no externally imposed geometry, if you think about it. But the gene expression domains tell a different story, as we have seen in the previous slide, but also here. So here we have 4 different genes now that we stain these gastroloids with. These are basically antibodies that we found on the market for free. It's easier than generating them yourself. If you basically take different cohorts of gastroloids that are grown at different initial seeding numbers, which are encoded here in color, you see that the average of each time 50 gastroloids, they span essentially the entire x-axis here in absolute units, okay? Because according to size, their patterns scale. Their patterns move out further. But when you renormalize again by the size of the system, everything collapses. And remarkable, and what's remarkable really is that the boundary variability here, even across different sizes, is again at the level of 1 to 2 cells, cell diameters, something that we have seen in the fly embryo. Okay, so this is really striking, because just like in the fly, we see that gene expression level domains are precise, reproducible, and also scale invariant here. But here, they arise, of course, from a completely completely self-organized context, no maternal blueprint, no morphogen source, or externally imposed axes. And this makes this system really an incredibly promising, not just for developmental biology, because we see these are all emergent properties of, you know, collective multicellular systems, and not just really because they have evolved in a specific developmental context. And these properties then also are interesting as physical rules that could govern, you know, engineered tissues or eventually maybe even synthetic life. All right, and so now to close, we have been able to quantify positional information by comparing inputs and outputs, morphogen levels, and gene expression, for example. That's the classic setup in developmental biology. A signal is sent, and we ask how well is this interpreted. But cells, organized systems like here on the right, these gastroloids, they don't start with a system. There is no really an input to track. There's just spontaneous emergence of structure. And so if you want to build a theory of self-organization, we basically need new tools, because mutual information, which basically worked in the case of the embryo as a performance measure, how well are we doing, wouldn't really be working anymore in these gastroloids, where, you know, we need to come up with something else if eventually we want to have to come to the statistic of these outputs themselves. And so this is where I think really lies the next frontier. We need to move beyond these input-output frameworks towards a more general statistical theory of morphogenesis, and I'll point to David's talk, with whom we were talking quite a bit about these next steps, and I think his talk is essentially largely getting you the continuation of this. All right, so development is precise and reproducible, not because it eliminates noise, it's precise because it organizes noise into some structure. And that's whether it's guided by maternal inputs or emerging from scratch. These systems are not perfect machines. They're basically statistical systems that reach the same outcome through reproducible variation. And that's where information really helps us. It's not just a label, but you can measure it to compare and sometimes even to discover new things that we didn't think about it before. And I hope I've shown you one of them today. And so if I leave you with one thing today, it's basically that precision in biology isn't just accidental, it's physical, it's quantifiable, and it's often more surprising than what you think. And so with this, I want to thank the many people who made this work possible. This slide just shows a few of them, those who basically contribute directly to the experiments and ideas that I talked about today. In blue here is those whose work directly reflected in today's talk. And in green are the collaborators whose influence was spanned over multiple stages of this work, starting with my PhD advisors, if you want. And of course, my deepest gratitude is to my two labs in Pasteur and at Princeton, past and present, and to the agencies that are willing to fund this kind of research. And thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.